Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, when was the last time you heard someone accuse somebody else, well, an artist, a musician, whatever, of selling out? It's probably been a while, but it used to be a pretty explosive accusation to level at musicians. Nowadays, you'd be hard pushed to find an artist who hasn't sold out in some way. Everybody from Duke Ellington, Bob Dylan, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, the whole lot, they've been accused of betraying their roots, ideals and sound in the pursuit of success and money at some stage in their career. So what does it mean to sell out? Where did the concept come from? And above all, who's been accused of selling out? Well, Kate Brennan-Harding joins me now to talk about sellouts. Talk about sellouts, Kate. Where did the term come from, first of all?
Hi, Dave. It's kind of fascinating. You know, Afric contacted me and she was like, I really like this idea. And I was like, yeah, me too. And the more I researched for this piece, I was like, wow. Like, if you had used the term sellout a couple of hundred years ago, it meant to betray or con someone. And Wikipedia actually, and I know people don't really want to go into Wikipedia, but it actually translates it as selling out or sold out in the past tense. It's a common expression for the compromising of a person's integrity, morality, authenticity, or principles in exchange for personal gains such as money. So, you know, we kind of get a very clear image of what to sell out means. And I think most of us listening or, you know, me talking would be like, can picture people straight away in your mind. When we go back to the 1950s and 60s, that's when it kind of took on, you know, more of a slur. And it was thrown a lot at black artists who people had felt, you know, black people felt, oh, you're selling out because you're kind of tailoring your sound to fit a white, more mainstream audience and you're selling out to the man. And I kind of, in my research, I found out about, I'd never heard of him, which to my shame, this guy called Cannonball Adderley. Have you heard of him?
Of course. Yeah,
but yeah,
the funny thing about it is that, like, you know, if you think about it, all the white bands stole the black music anyway.
But that's exactly it. Do you know what I mean? But I can understand from a cultural oppressive kind of place, you would be going, hang on a minute, what are you doing kowtowing to them? Stick to your roots.
He was a guy who played saxophone, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he played for Miles Davis as well, and he was kind of like into all the bop. He was the biggest saxophonist, so I would imagine that we'd know a lot of stuff that he played on, or I would know a lot of stuff he played on, just didn't realise it was him. But he was subjected to huge vitriol from fans, and he said, show me a solvent jazz band, I'll show you a band accused of selling out. Mm-hmm. And I think that stands and resonates to this day. You know, you have sellouts, which are around integrity, but then you have kind of, I suppose, begrudgery. So it's like a fine line. It's always a balance between them. And then we've got, you know, we've got artists that we're going to take a look at Bob Dylan in a minute, but it's like we've got artists that go from the 50s and 60s and huge political, you know, the intersection of politics, and we didn't have so much advertising thrown at us. And now we have today, where music is made for TikTok rather than music being made for the
By the way,
music.
We're not talking about somebody who does a tour and all the tickets sell.
No.
It's not that sellout. Okay, fair enough. So then let's go for it. Who were the artists most famously accused of selling out and why?
Well, I think one of the interesting ones is Bob Dylan. So Bob Dylan, he caused absolute uproar amongst folk revivalists and folk purists when, you know what he did? Of course, you know what he did. He went electric. He stopped with the acoustic guitar. He started going electric. And he played at Newport Festival, Newport Folk Festival. I think you have a clip there, Dave, do you?
I do indeed, yeah. Now, this was the folk festival, like he's supposed to be doing his good old folk music. It's supposed to be a famous picture of a very famous folk person with a big axe cutting all the wires that go to the electricity.
Well, that's it. And not just that.
Or somebody,
Yeah, the sound engineers were actually messing with the sound as well all through the set. But when you get to the end of that clip, you start to hear the fans booing.
Yeah, here we go. Hold on a second.
It's something else.
Yeah,
it's
indeed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in fact, look, hold
they're
on.
They're all so quiet. I'll play four or five songs and they don't make a sound. I'll just go, boo. And then Albert will come and go, boo. Right. Did you see one paper that said, everybody walked out?
I haven't seen that one.
Everybody walked out. It's on paper. It said, everybody walked out. Liverpool, I thought.
They're really losing their minds.
I'm going to walk out.
We want the real killing. Don't stand up.
Yeah, it's not totally easy to hear that, but he's basically saying, like, yeah, whatever, you know.
He is saying whatever, and there's some great interviews that I was reading with him that were done around the time, and he was like, he kind of loved it. He was like, yeah, I don't care, you know, do it, boo me, and he would keep going. But like, he also talks about, from artistic merit, he talks about it like he felt that if he was just going to stick with the same folk acoustic guitar, he'd be on his own, and he wanted to play with lots of people on stage, and he wanted to evolve his own music. So I think he's maintained his integrity while folk revivalists, the folk purists were, you know, really, really not happy with him.
Yeah, right. Okay, so around the same time, The Who, or a little bit later?
Yeah, and this, you know, as a lot of people will know, and maybe some people won't, they had a concept album called The Who Sell Out, and the concept was literally them selling out. So the whole album was based around Radio London, and it was the whole, like, for example, if you listen to it from beginning to end, it's like you're listening to a radio station, and it's got jingles in it for Beans, the photos of Pete Townsend and Daltrey, like they're, you know, advertising, and it's all completely and utterly taking the mick. But it also is a reference to the fact that they were actually actively selling themselves to commercials and making money.
What's for tea, ma'am?
What's for tea, darling? Darling, I said, what's for tea?
What's for tea, daughter?
More music.
Yeah, in fact, that album was re-released just a few months ago, I think.
It was.
The Who, Sell Out, yeah. Okay, so take the Beatles then. What did they do to sell out?
Well, the reason I put the Beatles in here is because it's kind of flipping it on its head. You know, when the Beatles, many people might know this Beatles story, obviously, but, you know, they're playing in Hamburg, they're playing in the Cavern, they're not really getting much success. They are leather-wearing, you know, kind of rockers who are really kind of going against the grain. And Brian Epstein comes in, their manager, and he is like, no, you have to get rid of the leather jackets, you have to get in prim and proper suits and at least cut your hair a little bit. You know, have it a bit, you know, obviously the style, it was very revolutionary at the time, but they were even more kind of shaggy mopped heads when he came and fixed them up. And if he hadn't done that, it could be argued that we'd never have Beatlemania. But at the same time, people were saying that they sold out originally. Do you know?
Yeah. What about the Jim Morrison and the Doors? I mean, when a band fights about selling out.
Oh, no, but I love this story because I'm a big fan of The Doors. And Jim Morrison, he had been away on holiday and he came back, and the other three members of his band, Ray Manzarek and Keurig, they had made a deal with Buick, the car company, and they had sold Light My Fire, the rights for it to be used in Buick commercials. And he went absolutely crazy. And he's actually on record. He was recorded saying a lot of expletives, but he was also saying, you know, that they made a pact with the devil and he sold us out. And he threatened, and he said, if you go ahead with this, I'm going to take a sledgehammer to a Buick on stage because this is absolutely not what we stand for. And it was argued back to him, well, you didn't write the lyrics. And he's like, but I'm the guy who has to sing them, you know. So I think that's somebody that's not being a sellout. Very much, very kind of 1960s, very against the man, very being true to his free love kind of message.
And did he bring a Buick on stage ever in Hammer?
No, but the ad didn't run. So,
oh, really?
You know,
I
think it ran once or twice when he figured out what was going on. He was like, nope, not happening. Do you know? And like, that's the strength, I suppose, of the courage of your convictions, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, like, also then, like, by the time the 1980s came along, everybody and his mother was being accused of selling out. So what constituted that? Was it ads, labels? Was it like, you know?
Yeah, like the 1980s comes along, and I suppose my memory, obviously, I'm born in 1980, so my memories start to filter through, the pop memories start to filter through from 82, 83, Top of the Pops, all of that. And for me, commercialism going along with pop music seems to make sense, because I remember Michael Jackson, and I heavily associate him with Pepsi. And that deal was done in 1983, and that was £3 million at the time, which was massive for the Jacksons to be the face of Pepsi. So we didn't have social media, obviously, and the big power was in branding. It wasn't necessarily selling your music or syncing your music. It was about the face beside the brand. So the 80s is, you know, yuppie time. People are on the make. And you get as well bands that are just fantastic who would be more underground, but they signed to major labels. And even then, the fan base is accusing them of selling out.
Yeah, it just happens all the time. Neil Young had a song by the late 80s about it, didn't he? Tell me about that.
1988, yeah, he wrote this, "Notes for You." "Ain't singing for Pepsi, ain't singing for Coke. I don't sing for nobody, makes me look like a joke." Neil Young has never been one to not point the finger, has he?
No, indeed. But like, you know, somebody like, you know, "We Built This City," Jefferson Airplane, Starship. Ugh. Now, that's a different thing, isn't it?
It's completely different as well because, okay, Starship are not Jefferson Airplane, but they are. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's pretty much the exact same band. And I think this could be taken, like, Jefferson Airplane gave us White Rabbit. They gave us Jane. They gave us so much amazing music. And they then become Starship and play "We Built This City," which goes on to be their most successful track, way more successful than anything they did with Jefferson Airplane. But that was considered a sellout because they turned completely to just look at what's popular and mainstream, and they chased it for the money.
Yeah, for people who like, you know, Coldplay people, are you seriously listening to some of the stuff they're doing at the moment with your man Max thing you were talking about the other week? I mean, jeepers, you know, what are they up to? Okay, but like, having said that, White Rabbit, by the way, was the cool psychedelic side of Jefferson Airplane. I always thought it was completely overrated, so it doesn't matter to me. Okay, now, into the 90s. Tell me about that. Max Martin, well, I was thinking of,
Yeah, it is Max Martin, who we'll be mentioning in a bit if we get there. The 90s, you know, I've been on talking to you about the 90s before, and it's like this kind of real explosion of different kind of cultures being expressed. So you've hip hop, you've grunge, and if you particularly think, say, grunge, and you think Nirvana and their first album, Bleach, very, very grunge, garage band. I mean, Cobain said he didn't particularly like Bleach himself. But when it comes to Nevermind, their second album, if they get in a big producer, there's tracks are overdubbed and their original fans are like, this is not the Nirvana that we know. And Nirvana blew up all over the place. They were, I mean, I remember the moment that I turned into a teenager. I went into a friend's house. There was a picture of Nirvana on the wall and I went down to the shop and bought a pair of jeans instead of wearing rainbow leggings. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, okay, this moment's happening. I better be part of it. Nirvana and Kurt Cobain himself said that, you know, he possibly would agree with some of the fans, the younger fans, that, yeah, maybe they did sell out. But actually, when you grow up a bit more, you might stop being so self-righteous. But he was, I suppose, the poster child, wasn't he, for grunge going into the mainstream, and the fashion industry kind of appropriated that a lot as well.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, there's always going to be people who like the first album, or I like the Japanese mango flexi disc that's only yellow and shut up, you know, like, I mean, like, they move on, it's cool, and they come up with something like this. Let's go to the album Bleach and go backwards. So, like, I'm following music, I'm in Aberdeen in Washington State, and I see them in a club. How dare they get bigger? That is.
How dare they get bigger? How dare? But I think as well, there's the thing of looking at people wearing clothes that you're like, you don't listen to that music, the clothes that represent what we listen to. So it's kind of tribalism, sort of, in a way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. What was I going to say? Kurt Cobain, Pearl Jam's, Eddie Vedder, all these people, like, they all did worry about it, though, didn't they?
They did, absolutely. They, especially as well, there was a category added to Spin magazine, the biggest sellout. Like, sellout became such a thing that you were trying to not associate with. Yeah. In fact, I remember MTV having kind of sellout shows and like, who's the sellout this time? And it's kind of like, obviously then it's media realised that they could stoke up more controversy and they could, you know, get more interaction and traction, which is essentially what happens with social media today, do you know? But they did. Like, Eddie Vedder was really, really worried about maintaining Pearl Jam's integrity and his own integrity. And I think, you know, anyone who says Nirvana sold out, I think they're just begrudging. It's the same as I feel in Ireland. Well, this is my opinion. I feel that there's a lot of begrudgery around you too. And I think that it's, I think it's kind of horrible. It's like once you get too big for your boots in Ireland, you get pulled back down, do you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. What was it he said, the lead singer with U2 at one stage? Yeah, I want to be like you, or I want to, somebody would stop saying, forget it. I can't remember. There's a good phrase about it all. Tell me about Aerosmith.
Okay, so Aerosmith, some people love them, some people hate them. Massive band since the 1970s. They had a lot of internal politics, shall we say, going on in the 80s. And they came back, I remember their comeback, they came back with Run DMC.
Yeah, how dare they? My God, Aerosmith doing rap or whatever it's called. Hippity-hoppity music.
Hippity-hoppity. It was such a great mashup. And I think sometimes that, you know, we hadn't seen really mashups until that had come along. And it was huge for them. It was really risky, because obviously you're combining two cultures, which, you know, are phenomenal. And in that space, they generated themselves up into being rock gods again. But then in 1998, they came back with I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, the movie soundtrack from Pearl Harbor.
There and you go, you know.
They died a death. Well, they didn't really. They just were like pillared for it. They were like, no, that's not okay, you know?
Yeah, indeed. Now, one of the big ones around the beginning of this century, or the end of the 90s, was Metallica and Napster. So tell me about that.
Well, a lot of, maybe some people listening don't know what Napster was. Napster was a file sharing system that was set up for college students. And it was really cool. I mean, it did take maybe an entire night to download one song, but it meant that if I had MP3s of a track, I could share that with somebody else that liked this track. So obviously music rights are being violated here, because you're sharing music and artists are not getting credited for it. So Metallica come along, and they're one of the biggest, they are if not the biggest rock bands in the world, in the 13th of April 2000, and they file a lawsuit against Napster, because, you know, they're like, well, hang on a minute, you haven't included us, you haven't asked us if we wanted to be part of this platform, the sharing platform. And that, I think, is totally fair enough, because we have to protect artists' rights and pay the artist. But then where it became left a sour taste in everybody's mouth, they actually got the details of 335,000 fans, and they went after them, and they went after Napster, and they told them to block them. And that was considered going against Metallica, that was in it for the make, in it for the money, and attacking their own fans. So I think, you know, there was a balance to it. And Lars Ulrich, he has said, like, I don't regret taking on Napster, but I do find it odd how big that became a part of their legacy. And I think he's kind of right, because, you know, it was such an unusual thing. People didn't really understand what Napster was. Now we have Spotify, which is essentially the same thing, but artists are getting, you know, paid, if albeit peanuts from it. But, you know, at least Metallica made a stand, I think, originally around artists' rights.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, I suppose, that the exploitative kind of tech companies give insultingly low payouts. So the concept of what you're talking about has kind of evaporated, I suppose, all right. It's a free-for-all, and the pandemic hasn't helped. If the touring doesn't make the money and the albums don't make the money, and certainly the Spotify doesn't make the money, then, you know, you gotta. I mean, guitar bands seem to get an awful lot of this. What about other genres? I mean, there's the concept of a sellout stretched to hippity hoppity music, one of the most bling of bloody genres.
Absolutely does. Absolutely. Like hip hop, I think people would be very protective, especially the late 80s going into the 90s of hip hop. And there would be, you know, whether you're West Side or East Side in the States. And then you've got artists who, there's one that you have a clip of, and it's Mary J. Blige.
Yeah,
and
the
she
Burger
agreed
King.
To do a Burger King commercial. And oh my God.
Well done, Mary.
Exciting things are happening at Burger King.
Welcome to Burger King.
Oh, what's in those new chicken snack wraps?
What's in the new chicken snack?
What's in the new chicken wraps?
Mary?
Crispy chicken.
Best thing she's ever done.
Oh. Now,
The new
chicken. Oh my God. I presume she got vilified, did she?
So she got absolutely vilified. But then, you know, so there's a few things. There's a few edges to this story. First of all, I don't know how she'd agreed to sing that myself. I'm looking at her because I love Mary J. Blige, but I'm like, what are you at? But she did say that what she was sold, what she was going to be doing was a dream sequence and not what actually came out in the ad. She said that was not what she signed off on. So it got pulled. And she also said that it was had racist connotations. So it got pulled for that as well. But the fact that she did it and she, you know, one of the biggest hip hop stars, one of the biggest pop stars in the world did that. It was kind of like a real slur on her or tainted her for a while. I felt. I think it was just like, oh God,
Burger King. And it had racist connotations, did it?
Well, it has racist connotations in terms of it was something that she didn't agree to do, and then she's standing up in a Burger King and she's singing about fried chicken, and she said that harks back to, you know, people serving fried chicken. Okay. So that's where it came from, and
anything
I can understand why
can
she would like
do these days. Okay, because that's only a few years ago. What about Black Eyed Peas? Speaking of food,
the Black Eyed Peas, probably my least favorite band of all time. But anyway, maybe up in my top five. But they started off so dramatically differently. When they released their debut album Behind the Front in 1998, they were considered a really kind of unique trio, and they, you know, they were elevating their sound. They had another album out in 2000, and it was really hip hop, really good beats, really good funk kind of style to it as well. I think you might have a clip. Do you have a clip? Weekends?
Of Weekend, yeah.
Weekends, yeah.
The place to be, to let it all out for when the weekend come. The weekend come. But are you not doing now exactly what Nirvana fans did or something?
No.
Because, like, I mean, they were really good at the beginning, but then I didn't like them.
Yes, you are. You have
because
a point.
Because other people like them.
No, you have a point, but then, you see, what they did is they take away from me, ultimately, from their integrity, because they bring in Fergie.
Oh, my God. Oh, my, they shouldn't have done that.
Fergie, and they become this pop band. And then Ella Funk was the name of the album. It had, you know, Let's Get It Started on it, which actually has an original name, which just should not be in existence. And it's got Where Is the Love on it. And, you know, the rest is history. They became this. They are one of the biggest selling hip hop pop acts there is, or there are. But, oh, God, I can't cope with it. I hate, you know, that track, I Got a Feeling. I really don't want to have a feeling.
Ever been a wedding or a party that has not been played it? Hold on.
Or Friday at 5 o'clock when the radio station plays it.
Yeah, but the weekend is here. Now here's Where Is the Love. I think you've fallen into your own trap here, actually, Kate.
Do you think?
I do, absolutely. Yeah.
Maybe I have.
Yeah. Change.
But
is good.
I still own it.
Anyway, go on. Tell me a few more.
Okay, well, I actually want to jump to Kanye West.
Yeah.
A man who is, well, now is known as Ye or Yee. I think he's always skirted controversy. But when he supported Donald Trump, that is when he completely was labelled, and I think in my mind, correctly so, an absolute sellout. He abandoned, I think, so many principles, and he abandoned, you know, the fans, the fan base that he has built up in the black community. And I think he was just doing it from a complete and utter controversy, stoke controversy, and get himself more and more attention. So there is, I think, somebody who has completely sold out. He's a musical legend.
He's not well, though, is he?
No, well, I mean, you would argue that, well, he's not well, but I mean, he still has power to make choice. Yeah. He still, you know, chose to chase this kind of more narcissistic.
Do you remember Moby finally got a major hit album and sold 12 million copies of Play, and every single song was used on an ad eventually?
Everything.
On the television. Good man, Moby, I say. Yeah. Why not?
Everything. And then you've got like Adele back in 2011. She said in Q magazine, I don't want to be tainted or haunted, and I don't want to sell out in any way. I think it's shameful. And like, actually, she doesn't sell out in any way. She just.
Not yet.
Music.
Plenty of time.
I don't think she will, unless some might argue that actually doing the James Bond soundtrack could be considered slightly commercial, but I don't think so.
I gave up on her after that.
Did you?
No, I didn't. I have no idea. Listen, social media, it's changed everything, obviously. So can you, I mean, like, it's like street cred, man. I mean, that's gone out with the arc. So can you even sell out anymore at all?
Well, I think there's very much, you can see a complete and utter divergence now again. It's like everything came together, and if you're on the TikTok social media side of things, you're hearing songs on TikTok. I've spoke to you about this before. You're hearing songs on TikTok. TikTok breaks pop acts, and some acts are only making 30-second clips to see, well, will this little tune get stuck in someone's head, and then we'll create a craze around it, and then, oh, we better release a full song, a full version of it that hasn't even been made before. So that's one side of the music business that I think has turned, flipped on its head. But then you've got a new wave of kind of punk, post-punk bands. We've got Fontaines DC.
Give them time.
I don't know. Those boys have great integrity.
No, I'm talking about the whole lot. I mean, obviously, new bands. There's nothing to sell out.
Yeah, but there's an identity that you create, and there's selling out now is not considered. Oh, you're playing May Arena. At least, thankfully, fans are like, I'm so delighted to see these bands playing Arena. I wish that they would play smaller gigs, yeah. But so many people want to see them. So I suppose you could be looking at it from that perspective. But people generally tend to find their niche, and now, you know, it's accepted that you can still be big without selling out. You don't have to.
I remember REM were in here on their first album, actually, and they were talking about they were just going to tour with the Police. So they did something with the Police, I don't know, and they said, like, it was just crazy. Like, there was about 70,000 people. There's no way anybody could hear anything that was going on. Later on, they played to 90,000 people. Anyway, yeah. Listen, thanks, Kate. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kate Brennan Harding, it is. That's sellout stuff.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.